This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. So excited for today's guest. A past guest, a concerned citizen, Phil Webb is back on the show today.
Phil Webb is back on the show, housing activist, would you say? We first had Phil on to talk about property deferrals and the unfair and unjust system that was in place. And actually, after he was on, the provincial government changed that policy almost immediately after, which I think Phil misread as our show having a bigger reach than it did. In any event, he wanted to come back on and we're happy to have him because he's been sitting through all the meetings at City Hall taking place with a lot of concerned citizens about the Villages plan. So it's kind of like a roving reporter.
Yeah, Matt. And we know you're listening, David Eby. Now we know. We put out the test and it works. So we know you're listening. Just a quick setup for the Villages. The city wants to zone about 14,000 lots in the city of Vancouver. That's about 14% of the city. And they want to do it basically in one shot. So there's going to be 17 village areas, mostly quiet residential pockets around existing retail clusters. So this, the inclusion would be up to 6-story apartment buildings, townhomes, retail on some ground level buildings. And right now, we're kind of in the thick of it, right, Matt? Because we've got these public hearings happening. I think Phil is like 151st in rotation of speakers.
He is now spoken, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I mean, if you think about, and we were kind of going over this before, just to kind of give a broader kind of context in terms of the pros and cons of this plan, before we get into the bone that Phil has to pick. But, you know, the case for is basically it's more missing middle housing, right? Apartments and townhomes off busy arterials. Of course, not everybody wants to live on Kingsway, right? Pre-zoning, of course, is a big one. So it means quicker application turnover. So you can basically build as long as you're in these designated areas. The idea that it makes Vancouver a more walkable city, you know, coffee shops, daycares, groceries, all within a short distance. And finally, it's attached to the $115 million from the Housing Accelerator Fund, which is the federal fund. So there's a lot riding on it. Of course, the case against it overall, Matt, at least from what I've been reading, the concern is that once it's in the ODP, that's the last public hearing for these 14,000 lots. So future projects get approved by staff, no more taking it to public council.
But which speeds up the process, right? That's a huge,
yes.
That's a complaint we've heard for years on the show about how everything has to go to
public hearing
consultation, right?
Totally.
But anyway,
totally.
Continue.
Yeah, and also a lot of planners saying that, like the one, including past guest fan favorite Larry Beasley, former chief planner, saying that like one size doesn't fit all, which is the concern around a lot of the blanket rezoning in Vancouver. So you're adding people maybe without adding services and things happen too quick. And then other people have been concerned about, the NIMBY argument of not in my backyard, which we talk a lot about today, and the land lift on properties that have obviously the best uses increasing. And then the only other concern I've heard recently is the rollout. Like it seems we're in the dog days of summer here. Strange time to be doing public consults, right. Whether you're pro or against, and an election in the fall. But it seems like it's, I don't know. I mean, I'm talking to a lot of people every day and a lot of people seem to be on vacation this week and next for sure. So,
I mean, this doesn't add anything to this conversation, but I'll say it anyway. Where I live near, I mean, the closest village would be Nanaimo and First, I guess. And I wouldn't be in the area, so I guess I can't speak to what it would do to my immediate neighborhood. But when I think of that, I was thinking about that after we talked to Phil yesterday. you know, it's like a couple, it's like a thoroughfare. There's a lot, it's changing, but you know, it's like gas stations, a 7-Eleven. I, when I look at the renderings, at least of this village plan for that area, I'm like, man, this seems like it will be a really great addition to the city to have like a really walkable area there. And I guess I haven't went through each village area, all 17 of them across the city, to kind of think through what does this do to change the fabric. But at least in my neighborhood, I'm a proponent. So
yeah, and if you want, go back and listen to Josh White, who's the general manager of planning and urban design from the city of Vancouver. He was on our show not long ago, and you can hear more. I think he was kind of most fired up about this plan of all the things that he was working on, which was pretty exciting. Matt, before we unpack this with Phil, who's been on the ground, let's get to our headlines of the week.
Phil is fired up today, we should say.
I love being the poor. I don't think I do a great job of this, to be honest, but I try and represent some voices, maybe of the people that are concerned about their homes. It's challenging though, because I can see it from both sides, but I feel like there's definitely some arguments to be made for people that have been in their properties for a very long time. I feel like they often get uncharacteristically portrayed as, you know, vicious or anti-younger gen. Yeah, lacking empathy.
I may have even positioned it that way on this show. So,
yeah. Anyways,
useful discussion nonetheless. But Adam, let's get to the realist headlines.
Yes, the realist headlines for the week provided by Howard Chai. Of course, you can always subscribe to Howard Chai's Substack at howardchai.substack.com. He's putting the real in real estate news. Such a great thing to follow if you're interested in the city and interested in real estate. So headline number one for this week, Matt, is the CMHC published its housing starts data for June, noting that through the first 6 months of the year, the rate of housing starts in Canada is lower than last year's rate. I can see why. I can see why in Vancouver, in BC, no surprise there. But an interesting headline. The Bank of Canada has held its policy interest rate at 2.25% once more. If you don't follow a real estate agent on Instagram, and I already heard that, but that was one of the headlines, of course. In the press release, they also mentioned that housing activity has been weak, but looks to be stabilizing, which was a quiz question on our last episode, if you remember. I think I got it wrong.
Adam, the other thing I wanted to point out is, I believe it was an economist from the Bank of Montreal, after these new tariff threats or tariff realities, whatever's happening here with the 50% tariffs or that just came out, is suggesting that rates may actually go down later this year with the impact of that on the economy. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. I have a mortgage coming up at the end of the year, and I feel like throw a dart at a dartboard to see where rates are. Who has any idea? You know, inflation pushing one way, economy pushing the other. But that was kind of an interesting headline I saw yesterday.
And the last headline, Matt, is Hootsuite has sold the office building on East 8th in Mount Pleasant in Vancouver to Whitewater West, a water park design and manufacturing company, for $18 million. So this was a big sale.
You know what's funny? That is a big sale. I used to go to the gym with a woman who, this is probably not podcast related, and she said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm in real estate, sell real estate." And I said, "What do you do?" And she said, "I design water slides." And I thought she was kidding. And I thought, man, that's kind of a funny thing. But presumably that's the company she works for, I guess. I didn't know that was a big area of the economy in Vancouver. But $18 million, that sounds like they're building a lot of slides.
That's every kid's dream job if they knew that job existed, I bet. So
when she said it, I was like, this is such a ridiculous it's sounding job that I didn't believe it. But anyway, Adam, let's pivot, shall we, to our quiz question this week. Adam, the FIFA has wrapped up. I would say, at least from my experience, it was a resounding success. I think that was
huge success.
Yeah, Granville, the PNE,
the Mexican barrio.
I went the Mexican barrio. Yeah, you live in the Mexican barrio.
I spent so much time in the barrio.
But resounding success. Here's a question I came up with, because I know one time you stopped by my house after being at the PNE. I was there a couple of times. It was a ton of fun over there. So we know, Adam, that BC Place sold out for the matches, but how popular was that free FIFA fan festival at Hastings Park on its single biggest day, the day that Canada beat Qatar? How many people approximately packed into Hastings Park, Adam? Was it A, 12,000 people, B, 25,000 people, C, 41,000 people, or D, 60,000 people? This was just for one game, Adam.
I mean, that seems...
But before we get to that, 60,000. Think about it.
Seems wild.
That seems wild. Don't talk yourself through it. Let's talk about one of our listings.
Yeah, Matt, we have a fantastic listing to talk about today. This is Unit 327 at 418 East Broadway. This is an incredible two-bed plus den loft, completely renovated, listed at $749,000. I absolutely love this unit. You've got 17-foot ceilings, basically a wall of glass that you look out with a mountain view in Mount Pleasant, tucked away kind of in like the perfect spot in Mount Pleasant, right beside Kingsgate Mall. One of my favorites. I also heard Kingsgate
Mall. One of your favorite malls. Yeah.
It has merch now. It's so popular, I heard. So two bed, one bath, 902 square feet, parking, storage. Go check it out on our website. It's phenomenal over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And Matt, back to the trivia question.
I'll just remind you of the four choices here. 12,000, 25,000, 41,000, 60,000. This was... How many people were at the PNE to watch that game when Canada beat Qatar?
So I feel like I'm gonna feel stupid with almost any answer here. I feel like 60,000 is too many.
Walk us through your thinking.
And so here's the other thing. I was there for a Colombian match, which was kind of awesome. Kind of wish I got a babysitter for that one. Now, let's see. squirrel. Okay, hang on. Let's see. I'm going to say 12,000 maybe.
Babysitter.
Okay, I'm going to go 25,000.
Adam, I probably would have said the same thing as you, but you are wrong. It's 41,000 people. At the PNE.
Wow.
So there, I think that number alone points to what a smash success this whole thing was. I feel like, not to bring politics into this, but I see Ken Sim taking victory laps. And rightly so. I feel like Granville is awesome, and so is the PNE.
I mean, there's a lot of people obviously involved in FIFA, but man, hard not to think everyone did a good job, because it was
feather
awesome.
In a lot of it people's caps. 41
made the city feel really great again. Absolutely. Matt, let's cut to this conversation.
Absolutely, enjoy.
Zentera has done it again, recently named Multifamily Home Builder of the Year by the Home Builders Association of Vancouver and the Canadian Home Builders Association of BC. Zentera continues to move forward on new projects, and their latest Butte, a new condo community in West Clayton, is now selling. With construction already underway, buyers can purchase with confidence, knowing that the project is moving forward.
Butte offers 1, 2, and 3-bedroom condos located just 3 blocks to the future SkyTrain, Adam. These condos come with tons of inclusions like gas ranges, air conditioning, and designer-selected finishes. Residents will have access to the rooftop patio, fitness center, on-site daycare, co-working space, games room, and tons of outdoor space with three playgrounds. Estimated completion is summer 2028.
The best deals are happening now. Visit Zentera's home store in South Surrey to get all the details or check out the floor plans at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Phil Webb. He is a local advocate, primarily concerned, it seems, Phil. I might be wrong about this, maybe just because of we've had you on the show, but mostly related to housing matters in the area. That makes sense? Or are you on other podcasts talking about other things?
No. I've pretty much all of the public's work I've been doing has been around this, advocating for housing. And mostly advocating on behalf of the working families and youth in this city and in this province who are struggling with housing prices or priced out of owning a home. So that's my state, because I find that group is tremendously underrepresented in the public narrative.
Well, Phil, in that regard, can you tell us a little bit about yourself for people who haven't heard you on the show in the past?
Yeah, sure. I'm a Vancouver born and bred. My kids are the 6th generation of my family, born in Vancouver. I've been living here for 48 years. I have a career in the insurance world, and I'm really, like a lot of young people, struggling with housing costs. And it really infuriates me to see the way that so many people are hijacking the narrative and not facing the hard truths that are out there and the damage that we've caused to the housing market and the challenges we've created for the youth and the future.
And Phil, so we've invited you back on the show because there's a raging debate happening, or there's city meetings around the Villages Plan. And we've talked about the Villages Plan on the show before, but the city's holding public consultation. You've been attending these meetings. So basically, you're our eyes and ears on the ground, Phil. Maybe to start, big picture, can you tell us about the Villages Plan, or just remind listeners what this is all about?
Yeah, I'd love to. But first, I mean, I would like to just take a step back and say thanks again for having me on the show. I mean, I recognize that I have no credentials and no qualifications. I'm just as I said in the first episode, I'm just someone who's on the spectrum who reads too much and is an insomniac. So my opinion means nothing. And so your readers or your viewership are perfectly willing and able to disagree with me. I'm a nobody. My opinion means nothing. You guys have got a really, really great show. And I've been listening to it a lot, and I got to say, not only a great chemistry between the two of you, but also, you guys get some really good quality guests. And so to be, again, on the show is very honorable. So I thank you very much. So going back now to like the Vancouver Villages program, a quick sort of 2,000-foot overview of that. The city of Vancouver has proposed significant upzoning changes to many neighborhoods. I think there's a total of 17 different neighborhoods inside of Vancouver that would allow for higher density development. So more 3, 4, and 6-story stratas and more multiplex buildings to allow for more housing. That's the plan in place.
So where are we at in this process? We're basically at the public consultation stage. I know that city council is going on summer holidays soon. There's an election in the fall. I know there's been some criticism around trying to get something passed prior to an election, which feels, I guess, kind of a standard lame duck kind of argument. But where are we at in the process?
They proposed that the Vancouver Villages plan has been stumbling around in City Hall for a couple of years, and they finally put it up to a formal public proposal in a town hall meeting and allowed for people to comment. And that's where we're at now. I think there was over 170 people that signed up to speak and comment on the plan. I'm number 130 waiting my turn. And I have been attending those meetings and listening to those speakers. And what I'd really love to talk about today is, you know, who those speakers, overwhelmingly, the majority of people speaking at City Hall are opposed to this plan. And I think it's really, really worthwhile that we look at who those people are and what their situation is to get a better idea of who it exactly is that's opposing this plan. So that's what I'd love for us to talk about today.
Well, Phil, so maybe in that realm then, so who's opposing it? Where's the beef?
Yeah. As I sit through these local meetings and look at who is standing up and opposing these plans, it is overwhelmingly very discouraging to see who is represented and the people opposing this plan. I mean, the city of Vancouver has this great commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion, but the people who are opposing this plan are overwhelmingly old and wealthy homeowners.
And what is, to use Adam's line, what's the beef? Where's the beef?
The beef for me is that the people who are opposing this plan do not represent the community at large whom the City of Vancouver Council is elected to represent. We're really just dealing with a small vocal minority of the entrenched incumbents who, you know, legitimately, they don't want to lose their neighborhoods. And these are common threads that I hear, is that we don't want to lose our neighborhoods. We don't want to be in a position where we'd be forced to sell. And then they cite concerns, other concerns like overlook is a big concern for them. So if they're in their backyard and they've got a 6-story building next to them, they don't want people looking down and seeing them, what they're doing in their backyard. And the other big concern that I hear that just makes me want to pull out what's left of my hair, is they talk about this deal of land lift. Are you guys familiar when I say that? Do you know what that means? Yeah, so that's when...
Yes, we do, but maybe for the listeners who are not familiar, Phil.
That's when the value of your property increases to the point where your property taxes become unaffordable. And of course, you then face pressures to sell your home. And this was talked about a lot at the city, both by the opponents and the people at city council. And I find this to be just so infuriating, because that's a narrative that needs to accept some really, really hard truths. And the number one truth is that the city of Vancouver has some of the lowest property tax rates in all of North America. We're talking 0.33%. That is literally a rounding error compared to the value of your home. So it just drives me mental that we're able to, or that the public officials are willing to engage with someone who has a $3 million asset and is complaining about a $15,000 property bill or property tax bill. Meanwhile, there are so many youth and so many young people that can't even afford a deposit or a down payment for a home.
The opposition to the village's plan, if I understand, they're saying, we don't want our communities to change. We're worried about basically what would amount to an invasion of privacy if there's a six-story building next door. They'll see how them working in their garden or whatever. And then this land lift idea that the values of their homes will go up so quickly. It's like a counterintuitive, right?
Yeah.
The value of my home will go up too quickly and my property taxes will go up to a point where I can't afford to pay them, and therefore I'll be displaced essentially, because I'll have to sell and realize that gain and move somewhere else.
Yeah. And as we talked earlier on the last podcast, there are still, even though they've reformed the property tax deferral scheme, it's still available. And there are multiple other ways that you can tap your housing equity to sustain the lifestyle which you become accustomed to. But I said it before and I'll say it again. If you can't afford your property taxes, you can't afford your home. So it's time to sell, cash in your millions of untaxed gains, and move on.
Do you see the village's plan as smart policy? Like, what are you going to say when you show up? When it's your turn to talk, I should say.
You know what? Legitimately, I've listened to a lot of these opponents of the plan, and some of them have some very legitimate criticisms. It overwhelmingly is about building more condos. And we already have excess capacity in our market for condos. We don't need more condos in Vancouver. What we need is more 3 and 4 bedroom homes. We need more places where families can live a reasonable life. I don't think there's been a real good consultation. I agree with those opponents. There should be more. I think there's a cause that there should be more consultation. But the part that just infuriates me so much is that the overwhelming majority of these opponents to the plan, as I said, are old and wealthy homeowners. And they are completely ignorant to the level of privilege they currently enjoy by owning a detached home in Vancouver. And they're also completely ignorant to the struggles and challenges that we've created for working families and youth today. So yes, it's not a perfect plan. Yes, there's a few things that we could critique, but we need more development.
Mm-hmm. I usually play the role of protecting the boomer on this show. So I want to dig into maybe... I'm just thinking about, because last time we talked about, you know, kicking grandma out of her home a little bit and the concerns around that. So now in thinking about this, think of this West Side family that, and I mean, maybe world's smallest violin, Phil, but this family that was, a firefighter and a school teacher that bought a home a long time ago. And now they're in a situation where, you know, they have a very modest income in their retirement and perhaps didn't ask for their property values to increase at the rate that they have over time. You're suggesting probably a reverse mortgage, which can be very costly for people, or potentially a home equity line of credit, I would imagine. I guess the reality is that, but in a lot of ways, you know, these properties that the price escalation was not predicted by these people that have decided to build their life in these communities, right? And now these communities, they've been anchored to them. They're in their retirement days. I mean, should it really fall on them entirely?
I'm not sure I really understand. Like, so you're asking, like, should we be placing a ton of burden on these older folks with older homes?
Well, I'm just thinking about like, so now, so here's an example. And I think the freshest example we can think about of like a land lift was probably when Denman got upzoned and all the people that own commercial real estate there, a lot of it that was passed triple net lease onto the tenants. Immediately, the tenants, you saw people leaving, they had to shut down their restaurants. It was dramatic. It happened overnight. Mm. And a lot of landlords potentially couldn't lease their places because somebody's on the hook for these property taxes. And it's happening in the commercial world more often than in the residential world. So that's where we see most of the concern is like an area like, say, Victoria, where you're seeing escalation in property taxes in the commercial space that's creating a real issue for the business community or for potential owners of commercial spaces or lessees of commercial space. I guess what I'm thinking about here is if your property taxes, if you've set your life up to afford your property taxes of say 12 grand a year, and then they're escalated to something like 20 grand a year or 22 grand a year, is forcing a change in your financial outlook that is not market dependent, it's policy dependent, and it's based on a city plan by a city where you're a property taxpayer. Like, don't they have the right to resist this? And isn't there an argument to be made on their behalf?
I'm not immune to that. I am sympathetic to that argument that, hey, look, you bought your home in 1980 and through no cause or no action of your own, the value went up through the roof and now you've got an unaffordable tax bill. Especially in the commercial space, I can definitely appreciate that because we have so little commercial land available. And this is actually, I'll challenge you on that. This is actually a market reaction to the bad policies that have been implemented. Because we haven't grown any commercial land space, there is a huge demand for commercial land, which thus drives up the price and thus drives up the cost. And so, as the American philosopher Thomas Sowell said, there's no solution, it's always a trade-off. And so if we want to fix the problem, like, yes, we have the problem. Land is too expensive. Yes, property taxes are going up with that. If we're going to fix that problem, we have to do it through development. In every situation, you're never going to make it a win-win-win. There's always going to be somebody who's set. And in this specific example, nobody's going to be forced to sell their home. This isn't Russia. You can't put a gun to someone's head and tell them to sign on the paper. They're just facing increased pressures to sell. And that's the difference. And while I can empathize with that, especially if you've been living in your family home or in your community for a long time, these people who are resisting or opposing these plans and opposing these developments are doing so for completely selfish reasons, which we can appreciate. Nobody wants to lose their home or lose their neighborhood. But at the same time, we can't ignore the fact that pretty much anybody in Vancouver under the age of 50 is priced out of a home. So we need a solution. We need to move forward and we need development. And unfortunately, that means a few people are going to lose out.
Are you sympathetic to the argument about neighborhood change? Like, I like my neighborhood. I don't want my neighborhood to change. These aren't lots. This is my home.
A little bit, but it's really, really hard. Again, going back to this case, it's like when I live in the neighborhood that I do, which is right across the street from Peony Forum, I do not like this neighborhood. I would move in a heartbeat. And on top of that, I'm paying a lot to live here. So it really infuriates me when I see people who have millions of dollars who aren't paying a lot to live there and only can continue to live in such rich privilege because of subsidies that I'm funding, I get really irritated by that. My wife and I earned over $400,000 last year. We're comfortably into the 1% of Canadian households. And yet still we live in a crappy two-bedroom condo just across the street from a Peony Farm, with my wife and I sharing one bathroom with two teenage daughters. It's fun. So when I look across the street, or when I look across the neighborhood and I see, you know, Mrs. Richardson, who's living alone in a three-bedroom home, in a quiet, tranquil, leafy neighborhood, who's receiving tons of public subsidy of my taxpayer dollars and saying, I'm losing my neighborhood, I can try to empathize with her. But from my own situation and considering my own circumstances, it's really hard to feel sorry for them. You don't own your neighborhood. You don't own your neighborhood. That's a simple fact. And I've seen my neighborhood change tremendously in the 14 years that I've lived here. And then, of course, when I go back to the old neighborhood where I grew up on the west side of Vancouver, it flummoxes me how little it's changed in 30 years.
That's a great point. That's a great point. One, and again, this is, I'm also joining Adam in playing the defender of the wealthy here in Vancouver. But what about, just to interrogate, like to try and unpack the arguments, what about, you know, somebody listening who's opposed to this plan right now, listening to you, is going to say, you're saying you're subsidizing me, but listen, I worked for 35, 40 years. I paid into the system too. This is my moment to reap the rewards of a life of hard work. You're shaking your head, Phil.
No, it's a really good point.
I just want to piggyback on that. And I've paid escalating property taxes over the years, significantly more than people in other communities potentially, because my property taxes have generally followed the market.
I'll touch Adam's point about the property tax first. These are really good questions. I'm glad you asked, because it allows to open up a narrative and for us to discuss a little bit more. And it's the, you guys are asking these tough, hard questions, and that is the wet stone that sharpens the blade. So I do appreciate that. I'll talk about Adam's point on the property taxes first and foremost. And I remind you that Vancouver still has the lowest rates of property taxation in North America of any major city. Like, as again, 0.3%, you're talking about a rounding error to the side, to the, compared to the value of your home. You've got a $3 million home and you can't afford $15,000 in property taxes. Sorry, that doesn't sound really convincing to me. Matt, your point of, I've worked my years, I've built in, I've paid into the system, and now it's my time to shine. Now it's my time to enjoy the fruits of my labor. That's a great narrative and I hear it a lot. However, when you run the real numbers, it just simply does not add up. The simple fact of the matter is that the retirees today, the senior citizens who are on pensions and draining our healthcare system today, have not paid enough into the system for them to enjoy the benefits that they currently do. If that was the case, our taxes would be 20 to 30% lower and our budget would be balanced. Our governments are taxing us today at pretty much the peak rate that they can, and yet they're still overspending vastly. Where are they spending their money on? You add up the municipal governments, the federal government, and the provincial government. All three of those together, seniors' benefits count for at least 50% of all government spending. So it simply does not add up. You're not enjoying the fruits of your labor. I'm the one that's funding your retirement. And you're leaving a huge unpaid bill for me and the kids to pay later on. So I don't accept that argument, because the numbers do not support it. Does that answer the question fairly well?
I think so. You know what? I'm just wondering, where do you think, like, I'm sympathetic to all your arguments here, Phil, and they seem logical and they make sense. And, you know, I'm part of the same generation as you. I'm empathetic to our generation and the younger people, because it's a very tough place to live. Why do you think that it's not being heard by that older generation? Is it like, are you able to get inside the heads of a wealthy boomer here and figure out where the blind spots are? Is it just selfishness? Like, what's going on?
I have tried, and I've met with several people who are like-minded citizens like myself, and we always just scratch our heads of how do we reach out to the boomer generation and make them aware of the privilege that they have and the fortune that they've enjoyed, and also make them aware of what life is like for kids today. And it is just a slog. And I don't know how to do it. I've tried reaching out to media sources like AM radio, which still has a large penetration for older people. And they just don't seem to be really, really willing to have that conversation. And if there are AM radio talk jocks, talk radio folks out there who want to have me on, please reach out. I'd love to chat. But it really is astounding just how completely ignorant these wealthy older homeowners are to the struggles that youth and children are facing today.
Okay, Phil, so we've kind of been talking about the maybe the two kind of polarizing forces or the two extremes, potentially the group that is perhaps the landowners, boomers that would not like change or would like a more modest change. And then people like yourselves and I should clarify, like, I'm not a boomer if you're listening. And I don't live on the West Side. So we all struggled to live in a high cost of living city. Mm-hmm. And there's significant challenges by choosing to live in this city, just like there would be in New York or San Francisco or anywhere, right? But it's worth the trade-off in a lot of ways. And that's probably why we're all here trying to make it work. Phil, are there more nuanced perspectives? Like, what else are you hearing? Like, is it combative at these meetings, or are there certain people that are kind of trying to thread the needle a bit?
Overwhelmingly, you do hear the same old story over and over again of we've bought and we've lurked, we've lived in this neighborhood for a long time. We don't want to see the neighborhood change. We don't want to be forced to sell. And our property and this new development is going to increase our property value and thus increase our further unaffordable property taxes. You do occasionally hear some valid criticism and some people that have really good points of where this plan is probably going to go wrong. And I definitely appreciate that. I think that's, you know, one thing that we don't want to lose sight of is that many of these older homeowners do have years of received wisdom that we have an opportunity to benefit from. And they do deserve a voice and we should be hearing from them. But I don't think we want to give them an oversized voice compared to the youth and the working families today who are paying the taxes that fund their health care, that fund their pensions and subsidize their housing.
What about, are there aspects of the plan that you're critical of?
Yes. Thank you. Good question. It's overly reliant on condos. Pretty much all these areas, they're going to be putting in at least two or three low-rise condo developments. We don't need more condos. There's plenty of condos out there already, and there's plenty of empty condos. We've oversupplied that market. What we need is more 3- and 4-bedroom homes for families to live in. And that's been some very good criticism. On top of that, housing does not follow a direct supply and demand curve. It's very, very messy. So just adding a few more supply is not going to create affordability. There's other things we need to do to create affordability. And that is reduce development charges or permitting fees, which we could slash tomorrow if we wanted. And that would knock 20% off the cost of a new build. We also need to pull out all the red tape that's associated with construction and building that's adding costs. And we need to free up more land for development. I don't think the city of Vancouver has made any new land available for housing development in the last 15 years. So those are things that we need to be focused on, not just building more supply. A unit is not a unit is not a unit. Like, a condo is not the same thing as a 3- and 4-bedroom home or a detached house. And that's what's really lacking. As well, if we're going to go down this road of building a ton more condos, I mean, I said it doesn't follow a straight supply and demand curve, but it does eventually. The condo market is already oversupplied. If we add more condos, that will tank the price of condos. That is going to affect the younger generations way more than it will the older generations. They'll be insulated because the supply of detached homes will decrease even further. So these plans are actually going to end up hurting some of the younger owners more than it will hurt the older homeowners as far as the dollars and cents go. So those would be my criticisms of the plan. But I'm not an urban planner. I haven't looked at the plans in details, but I do also see tremendous amount of micromanagement when I look at these plans. They have, well, we're going to put a pharmacy here and we're going to put a medical clinic here. And it's like, why don't you just get out of the way and let the market decide?
I don't know if we need another dentist or physiotherapist anywhere in a retail, ground-oriented retail space in the city of Vancouver. It's an interesting point, though, that there's an inequality in the benefits of along the lines of real estate, right? That you know, we've always said if you can swing a single-family home in the city of Vancouver, you know, it's the in terms of investment, it's obviously the best option because you own the land, but also there's no more supply, right? And in fact, they're just decreasing. But it's an interesting idea that there's a generational kind of component to appreciation. I feel like I've never really thought about that, that the generational inequalities that you're kind of outlining here are also passed along in terms of ownership and who owns what, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And Paul Kershaw at Generation Squeeze ran a bit a while ago speaking specifically to that. And he showed that in Canada, specifically in British Columbia, most new home purchases in the last 2 or 3 years, like a surprisingly large number of them didn't involve a mortgage. And so what is that? That's because everybody's getting their money. The only people that are able to afford a home nowadays are people who are getting their money from the bank of mom and dad. And that's really interesting to see that, you know, and it's nice to see that people are being generous to their next generations. But if you dig a little bit deeper, it unearths a real significant problem that we're having in Canada. And if you ask most young people today, is Canada a meritocracy? And they will say no. And the reason for that is, you know, you used to be able to gauge someone's success in life quite accurately by looking at their level of education, their occupation, or their income. And now in Canada, those three factors have nothing to do with the success that you might have in life. The most positive predictor of success in life is your inheritance. So choosing your parents is the most important economic decision that we have today. So we have made, and it sounds really crazy for me to say this, but Canada has now devolved from a meritocracy back towards more like a medieval society where the landowning nobility enjoy a comfortable life while the rest of us toil for nothing. And I know that sounds lunatic and crazy and probably something you'd hear on the Joe Rogan podcast, but the numbers do support that.
But clearly, Phil, a meritocracy is not always based on equality.
Tell me more what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, access to education, money for education, where you grow up and the schools that you're able to attend, influenced by parents based on their profession, patronage, all of that. I mean, it's all part of a meritocracy.
Yeah, and just nowhere ever has a perfect meritocracy. There's always going to be advantages that some people are going to have over others. But the whole idea that we have in the Canadian experiment is that we're all meant to have the same opportunity. And that's obviously we don't get there, but we're trying. And for the young people today, they do not have an opportunity to buy a home and build a family. And that is a major drain on our country and our society.
Well, maybe just thinking about kind of solutions to this issue. Mm-hmm. Because I know you're highly critical of the state subsidies for seniors, basically, that don't seem to have, you know, it's not based on your net worth. It's based on your age, right? As I understand. Can we talk a little bit about that? But then what type of large scale reforms? Because if you don't want, you know, DCCs and community amenity contributions for new development, right? It essentially means higher property taxes, which is presumably what you're advocating for. But what other changes do you see Canada needing to make in order to get back to, you know, something that looks like meritocracy?
Yeah, this is going to be a bit of a controversial. That's also a really good question. So thanks for asking. And it's got a lot of wonky stuff. So just bear with me while I try and explain myself. And it's not a fully formed narrative, and it's just I'm kind of working through it on my first times here. I want to reiterate, I'm not against subsidies for seniors. My uncle is poor and would be dead in a ditch 5 years ago if it wasn't for the senior subsidies that he was getting. And I'm happy to pay my taxes to support that. What I am against is subsidies for wealthy. And as I said, seniors are getting over half of all government spending, and they represent 22% of our population. Very few of them are actually contributing net taxation. Most are getting more in tax cash-free handouts from Ottawa than they're getting than they're paying in taxes. A big chunk of that is this program we call old age security. Now, old age security was adopted to prevent seniors from falling into abject poverty. It's not a huge amount of money that you're getting, but it starts at $18,000 a year per senior. It is almost universal. The only qualifications that you have is that you must live in Canada for 10 years and be 65 years old. There is no contribution required. It is funded entirely out of general revenues. $18,000 a year, it's not a ton, but what's ridiculous is that they only start to claw it back at $95,000 a year of income. And it's not eliminated until you reach $153,000 of personal income. There are literally senior couples living in multi-million dollar mansions in Vancouver, generating $300,000 of income a year in retirement and still getting a dollop of state aid. That is obscene. My mother is a great example. She's worth, probably won't like me saying this, but she's probably not going to hear it. She's probably worth about $4.3 or $4.4 million. Last year, she generated, I think it was $115,000 of taxable income, and she still got $300 a month from OAS. Now, they're going to say, well, we've paid into that. That's a pension that we funded. We deserve to get some of that back. No, that's not true. Old age security is a pay-as-you-go pension. There's no investment savings pot. It's literally dollar in today, dollar out tomorrow. It's being funded by general revenues of taxation and debt. So the $300 a month that my mom is getting from OAS is literally coming out of my pocket and into hers. It doesn't make sense for us to be using, an antiquated model to be funding seniors' retirements when so many of them are already still very wealthy. The one thing we could do to fix that was obviously be to reduce the thresholds at which it's clawed back. But I think we need to look at net worth when we're qualifying these people. So if you have a home that's worth more than $2 million, no seniors pension for you. You can pay your own way. Thank you very much. The other aspect of OAS is that it is the largest line item on the federal government's balance sheet. They're budgeting, I think, almost $90 billion a year to be spent on OAS. That's about 20% of all government spending. Here's a really fun part. Generation Squeeze noted that $17 billion of that is going to seniors with $1 million homes and six-figure incomes. So that's essentially a third of our deficit that is going to line the pockets of wealthy seniors. And there's easy, quick fixes that we can do to change that.
Maybe as a final question, Phil, how's your relationship with your mom?
Oh, great. We get along great.
No, I'm just kidding. No. What does an ideal situation in Vancouver look like? Like, what do you hope the future of this city looks like?
I hope that it's still a great city. So it is attractive to live here. So you expect that housing prices are going to be a little bit higher. But as of now, they're just completely out of whack. In most of these neighborhoods that we're talking about upzoning, you need an income of over $600,000 to buy a detached home. That's out of reach for even people in the 1% like me. So we need to have some sort of development. We need to have free up some land. We need to make housing accessible because these are the people who do the work and pay the taxes that fund the pensions and healthcare that seniors need.
So you're speaking at the, I kind of feel like, you know how people put the eyes in the popcorn emoji for watching things? When are you speaking? Like, how does that work? I've never spoken at one of these meetings. Like, do they say, hey, we're at 122, so expect to speak tonight kind of thing. How can people find out more about when you're speaking?
You can look on the Vancouver City Hall. The Vancouver City has a webpage where they live stream their public meetings. I'm speaker number 130, so you can just Google that and find it. I'm speaker number 130. I think they closed the event last night at speaker 89, and they'll be recessing to Wednesday morning to start at 9:30 a.m. for speaker number 90. So I should be getting my shot somewhere around noon.
Do people catcall? Like, I just wanted, like, do people jeer and stuff like that? Or is it just like you get the respect of the room and have at it?
Have you really not watched one of these, Matt? I'm shocked that we've been doing this show for over 10 years here and you've never watched a...
I just play a responsible citizen on the podcast.
Yeah.
They have a few people in the chamber room upstairs, but most of us are sitting downstairs waiting for our chance to speak. I haven't heard a lot of cheering or jeering, mostly because pretty much everybody standing up there is a 75-year-old lady who's bitching about her neighborhood and opposing the plan. So they're mostly a sympathetic audience, but I'm pretty confident that I'm not going to be making a lot of friends when I say my two bits.
Right on.
Luckily, if there's a massive crowd of people who are, with the angry pitchforks and torches coming after me, they're all 75 and 80 years old, so I can just walk away at first pitch.
Oh boy, well, you heard it here first. Phil, how can people follow along, find out more about you? And oh, actually, you know what? We've got the Five Wire. I didn't even think of it, but we got Five Wire, five lighthearted questions that we end every show with. Phil, do you got time for that?
Yeah, sure.
Well, here's question number one, a book you've read recently that you'd recommend for our listeners.
Yes.
Since you've been on the show, Phil has walked to his bookshelf.
The World for Sale by Javier Blas and Jack somebody. It's all about commodity traders like Glencore and Trafigura, trading oil and the like. It's nonfiction. It's one of the best nonfiction book I've read in a long time. So highly recommend that one.
Wow. That's an interesting one, especially for an insomniac. That almost sounds, I know it's, you said it's riveting, but it sounds like something you'd be using to try and get yourself to sleep.
The book opens with, I think it was the CEO of Trafigura, who's a multi-billion dollar commodities trading platform. And he's flying into Eastern Libya in the middle of the war in 2014, trying to make oil deals while things are blowing up around him. And this is a guy who's worth like hundreds of millions of dollars. It is wild to see the risks that these guys take.
Wow.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Since you've been on the show, maybe, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Standing up at public meetings and getting involved in civics, as I'm doing right now. We had amazing success. I think it was a week after the episode we aired about property tax deferral, and the BC government reformed their program. So you guys were very instrumental in that, clearly. don't just sit around and gripe and groan. Get involved, write your MLA, show up at City Hall, let these people know what's going on.
Phil, what have you been binge watching lately, or a movie recommendation?
Well, the new season of House of Dragon came out, so I started that one over again. But you know, I get an hour of time to watch TV before I go to bed, and that's about it. So
oh, I didn't realize that new season's out. Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It's fun when you watch the George R.R. Martin movies, or when you watch them a second time, you become a lot more sympathetic to the villains. Like the second time watching Game of Thrones, you're like, actually, the Lannisters weren't that bad. They were just trying to do the right thing to themselves. Yeah. So, Catelyn Stark, what a clown. Jesus. Anyhow.
Yeah.
Any music recommendation? What are you listening to this summer?
I found a really fun metal band called Kellermensch, and they're a metal band, but they've got a four-piece string section, so violin, cello, oboe, and one other one. So it's really very, very neat. Yeah.
Wow. Last but not least, something that you've bought for under $2,500 that's had a positive impact on your life.
All-wheel drive. Cars with all-wheel nice. Drive. Yeah, like I said before, polarized sunglasses. Once you go black, you'll never go back. Now, once I've driven a car with all-wheel drive, I'm never going back.
You heard it here first. Well, thanks, Phil. Everybody's got to tune into these meetings. I'm not sure if you'll probably have spoken by the time this goes live, but you're doing God's work. And how can people find out? Where are you active, Phil? Are you active on what was formerly Twitter or?
No social media.
How can people follow along? No social.
I don't know. I've been toying with the idea of putting out a social media account, but I've always stayed away from that because I'm way too concerned that I'd be late at night after a couple of pops and telling the world what I really think.
Fair enough.
Better to do it here.
Then have a mob of people with pitchforks and torches, and I wouldn't be able to walk away at a brisk pace.
Well, thanks for taking the time today, Phil. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I really, again, like, really happy to be on the show. It's I know this sounds like baloney, but it is. I am quite honored that you guys have me on again. And remember, I'm acting alone and independent from my company. These are just my own views and thoughts. This narrative I'm presenting is still not really fully formed, so there's probably some things I'm going to get wrong. You're free to disagree, but it is a narrative that we need to push forward. We need to be, the people who are opposing development are essentially, they are essentially operating completely from self-interested motives. And in turn, they're shutting out the next generations from owning a home.
All right. Well, thank you again, Phil. Well, hey, next time, I really am starting to think you as the roving reporter, the next big ticket debate that's happening in the city, we'll have to have you back and get your take.
Yeah, sure.
So thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with concerned citizen and housing activist, Phil Webb.
Phil Webb, passionate guy. Passionate guy. I don't know.
Tell me what you really think, Phil.
Don't hold back. Here's the thing. I wanna just circle back on the I don't think I did a good job explaining this, but I felt pretty stupid after saying, well, our meritocracy is based on equality, because it was kind of like that was supposed to be a benchmark. But what I meant by that was that I think a common critique of a system of meritocracy is that not everybody actually starts on the same footing, right?
Yeah, no system is entirely equal. That's what I took from your comment.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's what I was suggesting, is that there's a whole series of unequal systems in place, but we do our best. And
But really what I remember from that comment, Adam, not to cut you off, was your use of patronage instead of patronage.
Did you like
feather
that?
Feather in your cap for that. That was
let's just say I've taught a grad course before. So here's a I almost pulled out Foucault in the final hours of that conversation.
I know.
Yeah.
You're like, but Foucault? What about the panopticon? What about the panopticon?
Oh God.
Anyway, great conversation with Phil.
Yes.
Lots of things to think about for sure.
Yes, exactly. And here's the thing, Matt. We have a lot of amazing resources on our site you can go check out. We've also got all the links to our favorite episodes over at Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. You can listen to the back catalog. And we love that you're listening. If you find this of use or useful, send it to a friend. And please share it with somebody that you know that might live in one of these villages, communities, because I think they would benefit from this conversation. Their land use potentially is going to change. Maybe not this time around, but this plan is definitely one that people seem to be behind. So keep that in mind. And Matt, how can people get in touch with you?
Absolutely. Love to speak to people about real estate who listen to the show anytime, 778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Yes, or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or we have the Kokomo line, of course, info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, and we're back here next week with another great episode.
No, Adam, we're not back here next week. It's August.
Come on, read the fine print. Weekly means bi-weekly.
Have a great week, everyone, and stay cool out there.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.